This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod. Who decides when a life should end? A case in the United Kingdom has pit doctor against doctor over the fate of a little girl.
Parents bring their children in for treatment, and then the hospital decides unilaterally that they want to end the life of the child. And this has happened now four times in the last 2 years, much more than that, in fact. But these are the cases that have been publicized where, against the parents' wishes, parents are ultimately being given death sentences by the courts.
That's ahead on the show. That story on Zainab Abbasi is coming up. A court only recently unsealed details of her family's ordeal. If there's a nation that's really struggling at the moment, it's Lebanon. It's already supporting 1.5 million refugees from neighbouring Syria. Last week's explosion at the port in Beirut killed more than 200 people and left 250,000 nearby residents homeless. The government has quit and protesters want to sweep away the entire political system, which they say is corrupt. Lebanese politics shares power based on religion, top jobs divided between Christians, Sunni and Shia. It has kept a fragile peace for three decades, but has it had its day? Habib Batar is publisher of TheBeirutReport.com and a fellow at the Reuters Institute.
The protests have long demanded an end to this system. However, it's not always clear to what extent the entire society supports such a move. The power-sharing system that we have in Lebanon, which has a sectarian tint to it, is the only politics this country has ever known in its modern history. And again, this goes back to the colonial era, in which the French colony privileged Christians over Muslims, although the sectarian power sharing had gone back even further than that. But I think it's worth noting that the system is very entrenched, and in some sense wasn't created out of thin air. It created because it made some kind of sense back at the time that it was, you know, established, due to the tribal and geographical nature of the communities, very different communities that were brought together. I don't know how easy it will be to change it, but there has definitely been a call for a change among a large segment of society. However, we haven't had a referendum on it.
It's had basically two leases of life after World War II, and then again at the end of that terrible civil war of the 1980s. Isn't this sectarian system the guarantor of peace?
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of this complicated power-sharing agreement that Lebanon is a manifestation of, which is just, there's been so many wars in this country, and the people who have the most guns have agreed to this. It's interesting to talk about a change, but I don't really see how political movements come to power other than through having a good amount of funding, a good amount of organization, an ideological base, and a lot of firepower, frankly. And the protesters don't really have this. So, like you say, the guarantors of the system are the ones who have the most guns.
If it is the guarantor of peace, isn't it also, however, the lubricant of corruption? Because I've been reading a lot in the last few days about the fact that you can't get a decent job without a sectarian connection, that the sectarian movements, the Sunni, the Shia, the Christians, hand out jobs not on merit, but on the basis of your sectarian allegiance. So doesn't it also facilitate corruption?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's also misleading to think that sects are represented by this system, because the system really represents those who are in power. So again, it's just political parties that are the ones that are handing out these positions, and no one anointed them to be the representative of all people belonging to that sect. They happen to be the warlords who are in power. So even if the system itself is even being abused, let's say, even if it was supposed to represent sects, it doesn't really do that. It represents political dynasties, usually, and men who have ruled the same parties for decades. So I can't say that the Christians in power today represent all Christians. They represent the militias that were the most powerful. And so in some sense, they are still very relevant because people fought and died with these parties during the war, and there's kind of a cult of personality around these leaders. So they have broad followings. But again, it's not really clear to what extent they're representative of the communities. This can all be used to maximize corruption by creating a crony capitalism environment as well, in which contracts are handed out to friends. But I wouldn't say that, you know, it runs every aspect of life in the country. I would say it definitely is part of the public sector. In the private sector, you know, people definitely get jobs of all religions in all kinds of different ways. But the public sector, the government sector and government contracts, again, less sectarian and more on a, I guess, a tribal or a partisan basis.
Yes, I've been reading about something, and forgive the mispronunciation. Is it called Wasta? I mean, what is that notion of Wasta?
Wasta just means political connections. It's cronyism, basically having friends or in power. And I think this operates in a lot of countries. I don't think this is unique to Lebanon or to sectarian power sharing. It just means that those on top tend to support their friends and give them privileges.
To what extent has this sectarian politics also made Lebanon a victim of the regional power plays? Don't you have part, for example, of this titanic struggle between Iran and Saudi Arabia played out through the Parliament of Lebanon and to some extent through the streets of Beirut?
Yes, this is a big part of our problem in Lebanon, is that the world cannot let Lebanon rest. The world must influence Lebanon. And so these different world powers, the US, Iran primarily, and then Saudi Arabia, France, all of these countries are very deeply invested in Lebanon for some reason, this tiny country. And they are basically the lifeline for these militias. And they have tried to impose their will on Lebanon. And they use Lebanon as a kind of a chessboard, where Iran is pitting its allies and against America's allies in Lebanon.
Habib, what is the chance that out of this tragedy, though, might emerge a politics that's less sectarian, more ideological? What's the chance that Lebanon could ultimately have what, for example, Nelson Mandela once said of South Africa, a country where whites are comfortable voting for blacks and vice versa? What's the chance of Lebanon being a country where the devout Sunni and Shia vote alongside the Armenian and the Maronite because they're all social democrats, or they vote alongside each other because they're all economic liberals? What's the chance of a more ideological form of politics emerging in your country?
Well, I think it'd be a mistake to think that ideology is not present. And I think that is also a major draw of the parties. You know, Hezbollah has an ideology, a resistance ideology, which says that we're going to fight for our land and we should have a sovereignty over it. The Lebanese Christian parties are mixed. You know, some of them support Hezbollah, other of them support a very Western and capitalist neoliberal vision, and same thing with the other parties. So there's a lot of ideology, definitely. I mean, the ideology in Lebanon falls pretty much on two lines, whether it's a pro-Western or a pro-Eastern approach. So I think ideology is a big part of these parties, in addition to their patronage, and that's what also keeps them, you know, allied with their partners.
I know that the political system does not require you to vote for a representative of your particular religious or confessional community. But I wonder if we could ever get to a stage where you have a ticket with an Armenian, with a Sunni, with a Shia, with a Maronite, with a Druze, all on the one ticket.
Yeah, no, we do have that. I mean, that's how tickets list, they call them lists in Lebanon, where a bunch of candidates get together and they're on the same parties. Whether or not we could have new parties, I think, is the real question with different ideologies. And here we come to a very difficult point. I mean, anyone who wants to pursue politics in Lebanon must grapple with this East-West divide. It's very hard not to take a position on that. Will you be supporting the U.S. initiatives? Will you be supporting the Iranian or Chinese initiatives? And so I think some of the new political actors are not really able to agree on a foreign policy. And that's really been Lebanon's main challenge throughout all these years, is it's been torn between these different world powers and people's approaches to them. this is where we stand today. And it's on this very sharp dividing line between East and West. Lebanon's kind of a microcosm of the world. In order for a government to come together in Lebanon, there must be some kind of behind-the-scenes negotiation between Iranian and U.S. power. So, you know, imagine, you know, trying to bring the U.S. and Iran to the table is almost impossible. And that's why forming a Lebanese government is so difficult. So I think there is an ideology that underlies people's sectarian alliances and allegiances. Lebanon has so many communities, and I think that's one big difference between a lot of other countries and examples that you might think of. There are few examples, I think, in the world of a country that has divided power among so many different parties. We have something like 18 different sects in the country. People do vote for them. You can vote for any religious party that you want in the polls. There's just a very complicated electoral system where these lists are created, where they're, you know, group all of the different sects together. So, you know, there are Armenians and Catholics who, you know, who might support Hezbollah, and Shia of Lebanon who might support Christian candidates who align with them politically. But it's so diverse. I think it's just really important to say that. I mean, you know, we have Sunni, Maronite, Orthodox, Shia, Druze, you know, all of these different parties really sharing power. And I think in most countries, you tend to have a majority and a minority or several minorities. We don't really have any majorities in Lebanon. It's almost all minority politics.
Habib Bitar, publisher of BeirutReport.com. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. A couple of weeks ago, Catholic writer Beth Doherty discussed whether Pope Francis could empower women in the church by appointing a woman to the College of Cardinals using a little-known loophole. At the weekend, he didn't go that far, but Francis did announce the appointment of six accomplished women to the Council for the Economy, the most powerful board inside the Vatican, and we'll keep an eye on that story. Now steady yourself for the next 15 seconds, because it's the sound of a double tragedy unfolding in a British hospital.
I've got chest pain. I've got medicine in my pocket. I want to have some.
If you sit up reasonably on the chair, we'll get you medication.
I can't. I'm feeling dizzy. Right. I've got chest pain. Let me have my medicine.
Calm down first.
Let me have my medicine. I've got chest pain. I will have a heart attack.
That's the voice of Dr. Rashid Abbasi as police drag him away from the bedside of his dying daughter in a UK hospital. The incident occurred a year ago, but a court only recently unsealed details of the case, including the police body camera footage. Dr. Abbasi's daughter Zainab was on life support, but doctors had decided to remove it. But as you'll hear, there's a twist to this case. It's not simply a grieving father challenging the expert medicos. Roger Siska is legal counsel with the group Christian Concern, which is supporting this Muslim family in a court case. And Roger joined me from Europe.
The case began in August 2019. Dr. Rashid Abbasi and his wife, Aliyah, had brought their daughter Zainab, who had a rare genetic neurodegenerative disease and also respiratory failure, into the hospital. She was being treated. She had gone through this before on two separate occasions where she had been treated with steroids and survived without them taking the breathing tube out. In this instance, for some reason, an agreement couldn't be reached, and the doctors at the hospital were very clear that they wanted to begin end-of-life measures and remove her breathing tube, which was sustaining her life. The parents, after being told this only half an hour earlier, were obviously in desperate straits, but they were cooperative. The hospital, however, called the police because the family didn't want to leave the bedside. And so you have the video, obviously, that a lot of people have seen of the father being taken out of the room, where he is kicked, he's strapped to a bed, he's having a heart attack. They won't give him his pills. And they call him all sorts of names, animal, disgusting, that he brought this upon himself. Yeah. So this is the basis of the legal claim.
Yeah, Roger, the important thing to point out here too is, apart from the tragedy of young Zainab's death, this is not a case of the expert doctors versus the parents who are simply emotional. As you point out, both of Zainab's parents are doctors. They are medical doctors. And in the case of her father, an expert, a specialist.
Absolutely. I mean, the issue at hand was her breathing. And Dr. Abbasi, 30 years with the NHS doing respiratory work, and this had worked two times in the past, the use of steroids. So this was not, as you said, just a grieving set of parents. These were experts. And so ultimately, what draws us to these types of events is that it exposes how ugly and cold the world really can be. And it collectively gets us thinking, is this how we really want things to be? Is this how we want to treat people?
What is the ethical issue here at the core of your case? Because yes, there is a very legalistic position, but there's also a deeply ethical position. What is that?
I think those are two separate issues. The core of the legal case is cruel and degrading treatment, which is forbidden by the European Convention of Human Rights here in Europe, false imprisonment, and any number of common law issues with the police, and the families considering also bringing the NHS in on this claim. The separate issue, though, and it's an increasing issue here in the UK, we've seen it with Alfie Evans and some other cases, is that parents bring their children in for treatment, and then the hospital decides unilaterally that they want to end the life of the child. And this has happened now four times in the last 2 years, much more than that, in fact. But these are the cases that have been publicized where, against the parents' wishes, parents are ultimately being given death sentences by the courts.
In the midst of this awful scene that was captured by the body camera of one of the police officers, a police officer called to drag a distraught father away from the body of his daughter, Dr. Zainab has a heart attack.
And, you know, when he was at the bedside, he was holding his daughter's hands because that is how they communicated with each other. His daughter would squeeze his hand. And so when he was initially arrested, a metal spike was used by a police officer to strike his hand, to get him to dislodge his hand from his daughter's. And I don't know if it was the initial stress of what he was told about the life-ending measures or it was that, but he began having a heart attack and he begged the doctors for his medicine. He begged the police for his medicine. It wasn't given to him. And he, in fact, had a heart attack, which required life-saving surgery the next day. And he's had two operations since then as a result.
Now, the tragedy is that Zainab died. So how much time did Dr. Abbasi and his wife, also Dr. Abbasi, get to spend with Zainab?
So the process was that within a week of this incident, a court case was brought to ultimately end the life of Zainab by removing the breathing tube. They got to spend the last weeks with her. Obviously, Rashid was recovering from major heart surgery, so he wasn't able to be there the entire time. They were the lucky ones in that sense that they got to spend the last moments. They didn't believe they were, which is why the scene at the hospital began in the first place. But we've seen this with other cases where parents aren't as lucky. They don't get weeks, they get hours.
You represent an organization called Christian Concern. The Abbasi family are devout Muslims. What is the significance of an organization like Christian Concern being so active in defense of this Muslim family?
At the end of the day, we share a common humanity. What's so striking about this case is the utter lack of humanity, the utter lack of compassion. You know, we're involved in this case for many reasons. One is just our dire concern for these end-of-life cases that seem to be on the rise in the UK, and just the lack of respect for parental rights. This idea that once you check your child in the hospital, it's no longer your child, that the state gets to decide whether she lives or dies. So that certainly was our impetus in assisting the Abbasi family.
Where does this case fit in to a pattern? You mentioned, for example, the Charlie Gard case. We covered that a couple of years ago. That was also a case where grieving parents struggled to keep their child alive. I mean, how much of a pattern are we now seeing?
Well, there's been four cases involving children, three of them being toddlers. And those are the public cases. Those are the cases where the parents were brave enough to be public about it and take a stand. But there are many, many cases that go on behind closed doors where this is happening. We represented a case perhaps 2 years ago, the Alfie Evans case. You had a father who didn't graduate high school representing himself in the case against Queen's Counsel, being expected to cross-examine medical experts. And so obviously what came out of that case was a much more dire diagnosis than what might have actually been the case. And based on that evidence alone, Alfie was life-sustaining measures were removed.
It does raise the question of how much effort can be made to sustain the life of a terminally ill patient.
With the case of the Alfie Evans family, that was an instance where another hospital was willing to take over in Italy. and they weren't allowed to remove their child from the hospital. So it wasn't a matter of we're not going to sustain life. It was we are going to prevent you from getting your child treatment elsewhere. In the Abbasi case, steroids had worked in the past. There was no indication it wouldn't work here. It was just that the doctors didn't want to continue treatment for their own reasons. They might have thought it was futile. But the parents, especially given their expertise, should have been given the right to make that call.
Roger Siska, legal counsel with the group Christian Concern. Now, the Abbasi case involved a six-year-old girl whose prospects of survival were possibly not that great. How many health resources should doctors have dedicated to give her every chance of survival? As Australia deals with a second wave of COVID-19, especially in Victoria, claiming the lives of people mainly but not exclusively over 70, this is a pressing ethical question. It's been preoccupying medical ethicist Dr. Xavier Simons of Notre Dame University. He's an expert in the rationing of care and joined me earlier.
So I think one thing we've seen in the COVID pandemic is that these decisions are actually very common, and certainly COVID has presented a series of ethical dilemmas that doctors may not normally face. But at the same time, really, it's drawn our attention as well to an existing reality in medicine that doctors are constantly making decisions about when they should continue or discontinue treatment for patients who have very serious illnesses and who probably have a limited chance of surviving. There's an estimation that doctors have to make about the chance that a patient has of living for a year or 5 years or 10 years, and often doctors will deem that there's not a very good chance of that happening. And as a result, they, in the case of a child or in the case of someone who's at the end of life, like a kind of an older member of the community, they may make a decision that treatment would not be advisable for this particular patient. But it is a very difficult and ethically loaded decision, because in the end, it's not just about whether a treatment is medically indicated, but also the value we place on quality of life, the value we place on life extension, and even just the value we place on life as such.
Does age, in a sense, really matter here? Because we've got this tragic case of Zainab Abbasi. She's about 6 years old. There's the possibility that some medical technology may emerge in future years that may make her life viable. But at the moment, the doctors made the judgment that there was little prospect of recovery. Does age matter?
I think that's a really good question. And I think one important factor to keep in mind in the case of Zainab Abbasi is that she, in fact, was thought by doctors to have very little chance of survival in 2018, when she first presented in hospital with a disease that progressed significantly at that point. And the doctor thought that it would be kind to let her go, as she was unlikely to pull through. But her parents, who are actually medical practitioners themselves, refused that and said that she still had good quality of life. And in fact, she later returned home after responding to treatment. So she was able to receive treatment, and that was successful. And she actually returned home from hospital and was able to live a fairly normal life to the extent possible with someone with her serious condition for a year. And then, unfortunately, she presented again in hospital in the summer of 2019 with perhaps more serious symptoms at that point. But I think this issue of age is definitely a very interesting moral question. On the one hand, it seems that our society does recognise that there is a certain added tragedy when someone who is very young passes away, because they do have their lives ahead of them. They may not have had the same chance to experience all those milestones that we take to characterise a fulfilled life, kind of a life that's complete. At the same time, there is also this danger in placing value on the age of a person rather than placing value on the life of the individual as such, just because they're a human being and their life has value. Because in the end, if you end up relativising the value of life to a person's age, then it seems that you've got a bit of a hierarchy of value in terms of humanity, and it's relative to a factor like age. And we could get even more problematic insofar as we relativize the value of life to other factors like disability or a person's health profile. So there is a risk, I think, in trying to base value on factors such as age.
There is another moral question here too, Xavier, and that is, even if one is at the end of a fairly long life, what is the moral commitment that we have to, say, a 90-year-old. What is our fundamental commitment to extending that person's life?
Certainly, we should recognise there is value in the life narrative of all individuals. And typically, if you just look at people's story with a very kind of empathetic lens, you can see how they have made a positive contribution to the world in one way or another. Even if someone is 90 years old and they've come to the end of their life, so to speak, at least from the perspective of society, we do need to be careful, I think, about if you are imposing a particular view of what constitutes a complete life or what constitutes a life that's run its course onto individuals who may not necessarily share the same assumptions. Because in the end, I think people at the end of life can have very diverse views about treatment and whether they want to live for longer or whether they, in a sense, feel that their lives have sort of come to, feel the narrative is complete. I think those are really important questions that we shouldn't answer for people, and there's a risk in rationing healthcare resources that we actually impose a very rigid and biased view of the way in which we understand life narratives onto people, and that actually kind of have a very nasty implication for the way in which we sort of will prioritise, I suppose, individuals who we think have a much more valuable life ahead of them, quote-unquote, than older individuals.
We talked about this issue almost 6 months ago, and I have to say I did not think that we would be revisiting this issue. What has the last 6 months, not just in Australia, but as we look at the world, enveloped by COVID-19, more than 600,000 deaths, predominantly but not exclusively older people, what has it taught us about the value of life and about the way that governments are indeed forced to make a calculation?
If we had a situation where, for example, COVID actually was most fatal in younger brackets of the population, in younger people, then you do wonder whether governments would have been much quicker to react, as opposed to the reality, which was COVID was ripping through aged care facilities in Europe, in the United States and other countries. And the government in the UK, just to use one example, and was very slow to react to what was happening in the aged care sector. That, I think, does actually give us cause for concern and, if you will, raises a red flag about ageist prejudice in society, this idea that the priorities of governments and health authorities are primarily people who are in the prime of life, and that those who are older and also more frail and vulnerable, they're a secondary consideration. And that, I think, is something that perhaps was reflected in the response of some governments to the crisis in aged care facilities around the world. And it's only something, I think, now that we're recognising was a serious issue. And fortunately, governments are starting to respond much more quickly, I think, when there are outbreaks of COVID, to use that example, in an aged care home.
Medical ethicist Xavier Simmons, also soon to be a Fulbright postdoctoral fellow at Georgetown University in the United States. Thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
No worries, Andrew. It's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
There's a longer version of that discussion at our homepage at the RN website, where we raise the controversial question of whether the pandemic may have dimmed support for assisted suicide laws. That's the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Imris Cronin. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.